And now on BBC Radio 4, there's your chance to turn detective. Brett Westwood presents the first in a new series of the puzzle that unearths the connections between people and places over the centuries. Landlines.
I think the thing that you can't help but be struck by is just the sheer openness of this and flatness of this landscape. So what characterises it for me is broad panoramic views under big skies.
I've heard it said that this is the loneliest place within 50 miles of London, especially in the winter. In the summer, it is beautiful. In the winter, it's still beautiful, but it's extremely cold. And the wind coming up off the estuary is absolutely freezing.
There is virtually nobody living in it away from the villages at all. There are, as you go towards Cliff, a number of abandoned shepherd's houses, and sometimes you just see the chimney stacks of them. But it has a fascination all of its own. You can literally walk for 9 or 10 miles and not meet a living soul.
Well, it certainly is a remote landscape. This week, we're in North Kent on the marshes of the Hoo Peninsula. The muddy Thames is at our feet, the oil refineries of Essex are just across the water, and if you carried on west from here, you'd arrive at the industry of the Isle of Grain. This is the spot where they recently proposed to build London's third airport, and if the plans for it hadn't been scrapped, we'd probably be under 10 metres of concrete now. The voices you just heard describing the area were those of our three local guides: Keith Gulvin, who lives just along the shore there, Keith Robinson, and Peter Kendall of English Heritage, who suggested this would be a good spot to uncover a few landlines. And I have to say, he was right. We've got wildlife, we've got literature, we've even got a man who spends his winter nights rowing in circles to stop his pond freezing. All part of the puzzle that the local guides have helped set for our two landscape detectives. This week, their ecologist and geographer Erica Towner from the University of East Anglia and poet and ex-Royal Engineer James Crowden. Now, James, I have to connect a landline of my own first of all. What's the line connecting military engineering to poetry?
Well, I think that you spend time in the back of a Land Rover and there's a lot of time to spare in the army, or there was then, perhaps not so much now. And you could reflect upon things.
So the odd ode between manoeuvres?
Or between breakfast and lunch, yes.
What about you, Erica? Because you come from Norfolk, so this low, flat landscape around us must be very much like your home. Are you a great fan of the flatlands?
Yeah, I like flat wetlands, lots of sky, cold in winter, plenty to see throughout the year, mud. Something I've always liked since I was a kid.
OK, well, as usual, we've got three landlines for you both to uncover today and three clues in the landscape. Now, the first landline is this. We'd like you to connect a water rail to a rampart via a persistent preoccupation in this area. So that's a water rail to a rampart via a persistent preoccupation of this area. And your clue is just at the water's edge, a few yards along here. So, Erica, what do you know about water rails, then, which is the first part of our landline?
Well, it's a pretty secretive bird, more often just about heard rather than seen. Member of the same family as sort of coot and moorhen. It's sort of a rather brownish bird, and that's nice sort of brown and grey with a sort of red bill, quite a long, pokey bill.
They're quite hard to find, aren't they?
Very hard to find.
Well, keep your eyes peeled, because you might get a clue along the water's edge here.
Very exciting.
This fort we're walking past on our left, by the way, is Cliff Fort, which was built around 1870, right on the edge of the Thames. And its sister fort, if you can call it that, is on the opposite shore. That's Coal House Fort on the other side.
See, plenty of rails near the water.
Ah, yes. So what have we got here, then? There's a gully, concrete-sided gully, leading into the River Thames, and the tide's just washing along its shores. Now, what can we see here, then, James?
Well, it looks like old railway lines, rusty, and they're held on supports, but they're only about 9 inches between the two railway lines, which is very narrow gauge, I should say. Brunel would not have been impressed. And they're disappearing into the water, and they come up from this end. It's rather intriguing.
So these are our water rails, not the bird at all, Erica.
Very disappointed.
You didn't think we'd be able to show you one of those, did you?
No.
Have you any idea what these rails would be for?
Could be for launching something. They've got a sort of, looks like an early lifeboat system, but with a military fort, it must be something else.
You're right about launching. Now, with your military history, can you take me any further down that line?
Well, this was obviously a defensive set of forts, so they would have been launching...
They were launching something very special and very particular, which I believe hadn't been used here in this country before.
Ah, it had to do with torpedoes. No.
It was to do with torpedoes, that's right. Do you know any more about that torpedo?
There's one sitting in Chatham in...
Well, this is the launch for that one that sits in Chatham.
Fantastic.
Do you know what that torpedo was called?
Is it the Whitehead?
It was called the Brennan torpedo. And it was invented, I think, in Australia by somebody called Brennan and brought over to here. I think it was first used here around about late 1880s, 1886 or thereabouts. Do you know how it worked?
It's a series of wires, or they... I can't imagine how wire-guided, unless they had fought the other side and they pulled it. That wouldn't surprise me.
Well, you're right about the wires, yes. It was shot, fired down this rail, and it sent out several miles of wires. And it could be steered as well. It had a propeller at the front.
So it's from the early wire-guided missiles.
It was a wire-guided missile,
fantastic,
yes.
Fantastic, yes.
Yeah. Miles of wire. Apparently, it was so accurate. It went at a speed of about 20 knots, and it was so accurate that it could hit a floating fruit bowl at 2,000 yards. So there you go then, you've got a pair of Brennan torpedo rails, which are the world's first anti-shipping torpedo, powered and guided by wires, and there's the evidence in front of us.
Well, this is wonderful, if you can say such a thing about a device designed to sink other people's ships, but I think
bowls.
It's... Or fruit bowls. I had heard about the torpedo, I've actually seen it, but I had no idea this was here still visible. It's the Victorian ingenuity at its peak.
It's great, isn't it? And the first of our local guides, Peter Kendall from English Heritage, came across this story about these rails.
They actually had a very short, active life. A factory was built to manufacture them within the dockyard at Chatham, and so, you know, they were regarded as the major piece of anti-shipping technology, but in fact they only had an active service of about 10 years. These facilities were never used in anger, but each year the different stations around the south coast did hold competitions, competing for a cup to see who was the most efficient and presumably how fast they could fire torpedoes and how accurately. And this one here at Cliff, the troops here hold the dubious distinction of actually having sunk a vessel, the only problem being it was a friendly vessel. The precise circumstances I don't know, but quite a distinction.
So not really a very honourable mention for those rails. If you remember, the other end of the landline is to connect the water rail to some ramparts. So to find the ramparts, I think we need to continue a little bit further along the coastal path. They're just down these steps. There's an awful lot of concrete, isn't there, around here? What I like about this scenery is the way, if you come round every bend, a different vista unfolds in front of you.
Yes, fantastic views across to the Essex marshes and coast, and great sweep of the Thames, lines of cormorants out in the river,
yes,
drying themselves on bits of concrete stuff out.
Oh, the old hulk there.
Yeah.
That's several hulks, I think.
Gosh, yeah. Ship's grazing.
Isn't that a wonderful scene just in front of us, yes.
Well, debtors' prisons were hulks, weren't they, Dickensian?
Well, this particular hulk here, I don't know how old it is, it's very difficult to tell. I suspect that's not a very old one there. But it's still a wonderful place. I mean, you are close to London, but as we heard at the top of the programme, it has a strange, remote, unused feel about it, doesn't it?
Wild and desolate.
Right, so, remember, we're looking for a rampart.
Well, we're walking along one to some extent.
There's a rampart under our feet.
Yes.
Erica, what do you reckon this rampart is for here?
It's on the riverside. It's built up with sort of boulders and is definitely being sort of designed to keep the tide out. And the actual rampart is built up quite high above the landscape immediately on our left. So suggesting it's a sea defence of some sort. It's following the line of the river.
So if you look inland, we're standing on one rampart, which you've described as a sea wall, very accurately.
Yeah.
If we look inland as well...
Yeah, we've got grazing marshes, and then we've got another rise. So whether we've got a sequence of reclaimed marshes, reclaimed land...
Yeah, we have. In fact, that bank you've just described is echoing this bank that we're standing on.
Yeah, it's running along the line of the riverbank. I'm just trying to see if there's one beyond that, to see if there's an even greater series of reclamation, but then it becomes very scrubby.
Well, what we have got is the sea wall that you accurately identified. This is our first rampart. As you're looking inwards, the second bank that you identify is also an old sea wall, which is a second rampart. So there are ramparts around here. Now, if you remember, we wanted to connect these ramparts to the rail that we saw earlier on. And what is the persistent preoccupation of this area?
Defence. Sea defence.
You couldn't have said it better.
I don't quite know when the reclamation would have started on this landscape, but in sort of other parts of the southeast, you had seawall defences built up during sort of, well, some of them are Anglo-Saxon, certainly sort of Norman, but some of the Saxon ones, and Romans were at it, certainly in Kent.
So it's very much a persistent preoccupation.
It's always been vulnerable.
Obviously, I think there's the sea defence in terms of erosion, but there's also defence in terms of waterborne attack, which is what the rail was about.
I think Cliff Fort and Coalhouse Fort on the other side of the river were designed to keep the French out. But also, this was a vulnerable point for Hitler.
Yeah.
Well, I gather that there were plans as well to flood this area on the event of Hitler's invasion, which and actually bomb the land, which was left dry.
Yeah, that would have been a very easy thing to do. Something that was contemplated all around the east coast, as well as along here and parts of the south coast.
Well, one thing we've certainly established then from our conversation here is you've both worked out very, very well that this was a very vulnerable area. It's been vulnerable to attack from other people, it's vulnerable to erosion from the sea. And you've connected the water rail, which are the torpedo rails, against any invading ships, and of course the ramparts, which protect the land from the sea invading. So that's the first part of our landlines completed. Now, we need to move on, but your next clue is over there in the distance where the land rises above the marshes.
We're just on a modest hill, but around here it gives you a most fantastic view across the gentle slopes covered in pear trees, a little bit of soft fruit farming, then onto the great flat plains, I suppose reclaimed salt marshes and mud flats right up to the River Thames and across the other side looking to a great power station.
It's just a marvellous sweep of the river. It almost goes through 180 degrees where we are now.
Well, we're on the edge of the village of Cooling. Jules Holland, by the way, lives at Cooling Castle over there. We wanted to squeeze him in just to prove we're not entirely stuck in the past. And this is where I want you to find our second landline. And this landline connects a literary fugitive with Egypt Bay. That's a literary fugitive with Egypt Bay. And just to put us on the map, Egypt Bay is about 1 o'clock. You see where the river just cuts into the marshes?
Oh, yes,
indentation where the river thickens. That is Egypt Bay there. And the clue to that landline is in the churchyard.
Well, it's quite a small, squat church. It's quite dumpy. I quite like it. It's on a mound.
Yes, square. Line of flint, dark line of flint. Couple of lines low down in the church.
And it's seen the weathers, this, by the looks of it.
It looks almost like a watchtower, doesn't it? It's got that sort of feel. You get a hell of a good view from the top there.
Well, remember, we're after literary connections. But have a look around the churchyard. Let's just have a wander around and see if anything...
Aptly named lady there, Miss
takes your
Marsh.
Attention. Miss Marsh, yes. There's a lot of gravestones.
Stone prop. Dry...
Some
quite
famous
well
author or character lurking. These look quite interesting.
Yeah,
very, very small caskets, grave, as if a whole family disappeared in a plague
children.
Or something.
Okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. About 12, and then there are four very small gravestones right in front, which are just barely a foot high.
There's no lettering or any clues.
The lettering's weathered off. There's one on the left-hand side there. You can just see some...
Oh, yes, stone, just the faint signs of lettering.
Faint signs of lettering. The lettering's all gone on the main gravestone itself.
So these are the graves
of...
children. These are the graves of children. There are 13 children who died here.
Well, they all look about the same age.
All about the same age.
Very few of these children lived to be over a year. Oh. And they were children who died... I think the 10 here were the children of one family who died in the late 18th century. And then there are three of a family who died in the... early 19th century. So a real tragedy here played out in front of us. I would imagine as well, living out here on the marshes, you know, with things like the ague or the ague, which was malaria from mosquitoes, maybe some of these children died of those particular causes.
It would have been widespread.
So we've got a very unusual site in Cooling Churchyard. We've got 13 very, very small graves, and in fact they're centred around the graves of the parents as well.
Yes, one headstone.
And these graves, this is your clue. So before I ask you to work out the literary connections here, I just want to read a little passage to you. My first most vivid and broad impression of the identity of things seems to me to have been gained on a memorable raw afternoon towards evening. At such a time I found out for certain that this bleak place overgrown with nettles was the churchyard, and that the dark, flat wilderness beyond the churchyard, intersected with dykes and mounds and gates, with scattered cattle feeding on it, was the marshes, and that the low, leaden line beyond was the river, and that the distant, savage lair from which the wind was rushing was the sea, and that the small bundle of shivers, growing afraid of it all, and beginning to cry, was me. So, what happened next?
There's a certain Dickensian bleakness there, isn't there?
Yes. Can't deny that. So can you tell me what the next event was after that passage?
Adoption
of a person.
You're right with Dickens. Yes, you're absolutely right with Dickens.
No, it's Dickens, not that certain.
So take me a little bit further.
It's not the convict coming along.
Yes.
In the churchyard. And so Magwitch. Yeah.
Magwitch is the convict, and the book was
Great Expectations.
And who was the character which I changed the name from his name to me in
to
that
you,
passage?
It was Pip. So this is it. This is where he got the inspiration from.
This is where Dickens received the inspiration, and Pip's amazing. Parents and his five brothers were supposed to have been buried in this churchyard. So, in fact, Dickens came along here, saw these graves, and a story sprang to mind. This is the beginning.
Interesting.
Well, yeah. We've got the connect with Magwitch, I think, sprang out from behind one of the tombstones.
There's a tombstone, the one we're standing in front of. You can imagine a great hulk of a man behind it, and you wouldn't see him. And you're looking at these children's tombs. You would be unsettled, to say the least, if anybody crept out from behind there, including the vicar.
Yeah.
Well, this is far more menacing. This is Magwitch. Now, if you remember, the other end of our landline is to connect and make a connection with Egypt Bay that we were looking at earlier.
Convict ships?
Yes, sounds like convict ships would either be... They held people in hulks before they went off sometimes.
Those were prison ships.
Prison ships, yes.
You're right. Magwitch in the book escaped from one of the prison hulks, which was an old ship which lay rotting out. Mm. And it's believed now, through research, that Egypt Bay is the most likely location for that prison hulk.
Yes, because it would be close enough for someone to walk across the marshes. Yeah. A dangerous thing to do there.
Well, can you imagine what the marshes would have looked like at the time Dickens was
writing? But you would have had the church to come to. You'd have had the
church to home in on, absolutely right, on the mound.
So that sums up our literary connection. Magwitch was the convict who escaped from the prison hulk, which was now believed to have been moored out somewhere in Egypt Bay, which we were looking at earlier. And these graves here in Cooling Churchyard are the graves that Pip mentions on the first page of Dickens's Great Expectations. But it's actually not quite as Dickens described it, because there's a twist to the hulk story. The hulks were either redundant navy ships or ships that had been captured. And one of our local guides, Keith Gulvin, has made a study of the hulks in this area.
So they were used a variety of reasons. So that, and they had powder hulks, for storing gunpowder in. At Chatham and Sheerness, there were ships used as receiving hulks to put new crews into, or old crews when vessels were in refit. There were stores placed on them. At Stangate Creek, they were used as quarantine vessels for yellow fever, smallpox, basically anything that was nasty that people were bringing back. In fact, there's a little island off Stangate Creek, still called Dead Man's Island, which is where they buried the ones that didn't recover. And during the Napoleonic Wars, they were used as prison hulks for French, American, and Spanish prisoners of war. And simultaneously with the prison hulks, also there were civil convicts also placed on hulks. One in Great Expectations actually is a Coast Guard hulk, one of several right the way along the Hoo Peninsula, which were anchored in sight of each other to stop smuggling. Dickens obviously knew the area extremely well, and he would have known it wasn't a convict hulk, but he knew there were convict hulks at Chatham, so he used the hulk there because it suited the story.
Keith Gulvin there. Well, for our final landline, we've come back down onto the marshes again. And here, I'd like you to find the line connecting a half-duck to the tables of 17th century London. That's a half-duck to the tables of 17th century London. If we carry on walking across this field, just keep your eyes peeled. Tell me what you see.
Well, sheep.
Sheep. Surrounded by sheep, and droppings. There are reed beds as well in the distance. Oh! There's a few peasants as well as sheep.
A few peasants hiding
flying up towards the table in London, I think.
And we're...
Ah. Now, yes. What do we see in front of us?
Immediately, we've got a bit of a reed bed. So a bit of wet ground, much wetter ground there. About size of, I don't know, four tennis courts, something like that.
Yes, I see sort of arms coming off here a bit. Yeah. Maybe at each corner. Yeah.
Let's look at this small area of reed here. The land you'll notice that we're walking on is raised. And the reed bed to our left.
It's pretty low down.
And yes, the edge, it's a very straight edge to this reed bed.
It looks very man-made.
It looks like definitely an enclosed area of water.
Well, we're coming to one end of the reed bed now. And I think you noticed, you said there was a sort of arm going off.
Yes, I can see another one here.
Yeah, we've got another arm going off here.
Yeah.
Yes.
If you look down on this reed bed, you'd notice it was square, but it had these strange tapering arms going off at each corner.
Well, they're just deep ditches, and they've got a slight curve to them, so you can't always see, if you're in them, you couldn't always see what was around the next bend.
Well, about 20 yards long, I would imagine.
At least, yes. I don't know quite how far that one goes.
And they would run into this area of reed.
Okay, so we're connecting a half-duck here to the tables of 17th century London. So what is it that we're looking at here, then?
Well, I think we're looking very much at a decoy pond, which was an old method of catching ducks. And they would somehow... They wouldn't drive the ducks into these arms. They would have nets over them. But they're just attracted in, aren't they?
I think when you see duck... in a pond, you'll often see them going towards the edge, going towards a sheltered area. So perhaps they were just attracted to it because it looked nice and sort of cosy and enclosed and safe.
Well, there's a bit more to it than that because these arms would be full of water. The reed bed we now see would be full of water and the duck would hide in it. And a special dog would be used and it would run between screens along the sides of this
willow
decoy. And as the dog appeared, the ducks would swim towards it. Do you know why they do that, Erica?
I don't know. I've seen a film of it, but I've not seen it in reality.
Well, the natural instinct of ducks, if they see a fox about, is to show themselves so that they're proving that they know where the fox is. Yeah. And so by using a small dog that looked like a fox, the ducks would automatically mob it. The hunter, the decoy man, then leaps out near the open end of the net, and the duck are flushed down into a trap at the end where their necks can be wrung.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, these decoys, and my Dutch isn't very good, but I think it derives from a word, eendecoy, which meant a duck net or a duck trap. And I think they were brought over to your area of the world, Erica, by Dutch drainers who were draining the fens. So we can thank...
Maiden.
Yes, that's right. So we can thank the Dutch for the decoys. But this is the only one that you can see in Kent that there's any trace of now. So a very, very important site. Keith Robertson, one of our local guides, he's been investigating the history of these duck decoys, and he told me a bit about the life of the decoy man who would have lived and worked here.
Usually they were considered to be, very solitary men and not well liked in the community. During the season it was a 24-hour job. If the pond froze, you didn't get ducks on it, so you would be out all night in a rowing boat, rowing round and round the pond to stop it freezing, making sure you took the boat in before the ducks came back in the morning. They didn't like people disturbing their ponds. There was a prohibition on shooting, usually considered to have been half a mile downwind and a mile upwind of the pond. Anybody shooting within that area could be taken to court. The fines were very harsh, because as soon as the ducks landed on the pond, they were considered the property of the decoyman. So the decoyman was immediately in competition with lots of people on the marshes. Even if it was just a case of if your child went out and disturbed the decoy, you could find yourself in trouble.
That just goes to show you that ducks were at a premium then here. You didn't mess with anybody else's ducks.
No, you didn't.
Let's just wrap up our landline then here. How does this connect a half-duck then to the tables of 17th century London? Erica. You must know. Well, the tables of 17th century London, that's pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
It's feeding the, quite well-to-do people.
Well-to-do
in London,
people, a lot of money.
A brace of bread.
Yeah. You can imagine spread. When these marshes were really flooded, yes, there'd be loads of wild duck here, and they'd be shipped upriver to feed
upriver.
Rich people in
very
London.
A lot of rich people.
That leaves us with a half duck.
Yeah.
Any idea of what a half duck is?
Well, half a brace is one, but a half duck.
But it's a particular type of duck.
Not a particular type of duck.
A half duck.
Is it a flight? Wait,
what does it suggest, half?
Flightless.
As opposed to whole?
Well, chopped in half. I mean, on its side, a duck on its side.
Let me put you out of your misery. The wild ducks were much smaller than the mallard, which was a duck everybody was familiar with, so they were known as half ducks. When we talk about wild ducks, we're thinking of teal.
Teal.
And widgeon and pintail. Yeah. So smaller, and I suspect probably more valuable to the tables of 17th century London. So there you are, you've got your connection. You've got a landline which connects this duck decoy to the tables of 17th century London, and at one time this would have been full of half ducks.
Well, that's been fascinating.
Well, just before we finish, while we're down here, right by the river amongst these reed beds and out on the flat marshes, I just wonder whether Dickens would have recognised the sort of vistas that we're looking over today. How would it have changed, do you think?
I don't think he'd have fully recognised the oil refinery there on the distance, and I think there would have been sails sweeping by, not these great container ships. But the sort of bleakness would have been... Yeah.
It would have been as flat. It might have been more watery. I mean, the reed beds have grown up now. They may have been harvested. There may have been higher water levels. So a more watery landscape. And a very, very dangerous one for Magwitch to sort of try and crawl across.
I think there would have been more people in the landscape. We see so few people in some of these remote landscapes now.
Yeah, we've got the cottage out on the horizon there, which would have had, I suppose, shepherds would have actually been wandering around the landscape.
Isn't they ever called lookers locally?
Lookers, yes.
Is that a great word?
Mm.
Yeah, I think the sight of swans flying over the reeds would have been there during Dickens's day, and actually they look quite sort of eerie in this sort of
you can actually hear the wings,
grey light.
Can't you?
Yeah.
Beautiful, yeah. A pack of swans heading over the reeds.
Mute swans.
Well... That's all for Landlines this week. Thank you very much to our detectives, Erica Towner and James Crowden, and to our local guides, Peter Kendall, Keith Gulfin and Keith Robertson. And if you'd like us to come and explore the landlines near you, you can write to Landlines, BBC Bristol, BS8 2LR. That's Landlines, BBC Bristol, BS8 2LR. Or go to the Landlines website via the main Radio 4 page at www.bbc.co.uk/radio4. But for now... From the lonely marshes of the Hoo Peninsula in North Kent, goodbye.